Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning.
Welcome
everyone.
To Blog Talk
Today's
Radio.
Monday.
This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Well, that's me, and I was a little bit anxious. So today is Monday, November 21. It's 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. We have a little house cleaning to advise you of. We're expecting Michael, but he's not going to be able to make the broadcast today from 10:30 to 11. But we begin every Monday at 10 o'clock in the morning with none other than White Plains Citizenet reporter, publisher, and editor John Bailey. You could find him at WPCNR.com. Good morning, John. How are you, sir? Hello? Well, sure, I thought that that was John on the line. We don't have the numbers of the people who call, so evidently somebody's on the line. We'll see. I'm just trying to think what else we could do here to find out. Well, who knows? In the meantime, I guess while we're waiting for whoever's on the line to start talking, I'm just going to quickly look. Don't understand what's going on here. Oh, gosh. Well, you know what? Let me play our commercial. And hello? Hello? I don't understand it. Okay, well, I don't know what's causing the problem here today, but this doesn't make any sense. Huh. Well, let me play. Well, the commercial worked, so the online. Well, let me play a commercial from the Cabot Creamery and see
hey,
if that's working.
Judge. Sorta. I report on cheese. I don't judge.
Well, I heard on the radio Cabot Cheddar always wins awards for
hello,
taste.
John?
Oh, I'm missing my notes. Best taste? Check. Best
yes,
texture,
John is
check.
Here.
The farm families in Cabot, Vermont have won every major
here.
Award in the cheese world.
Every award?
Every.
What about the U.S. John. Cheese Championships?
Cabot's won that many times.
How about the American Cheese Society Contest?
Cabot won it.
World Cheese Championship Award?
Best in class on cheddar.
Fiery Food Challenge.
Cabot.
International Fancy Food Show.
Cabot rules.
The Stanley Cup.
That's hockey. Look, Cabot's won awards for best sharp, best light, best butter, and best cheddar.
Yeah, but a certain big cheese company's TV ad show, they won an award from judges wearing bright yellow lab coats.
Oh, those are actors.
Not real judges?
Real judges wear white lab coats.
They do.
Look, Cabot is best because they own the company, ship the milk, make the cheese. They won so many times, the real judges even asked one of Cabot's cheesemakers to be a judge.
I don't believe you.
Here, taste.
Hey, I can taste why Cabot's won every award.
You be the judge.
And I get to wear a yellow lab coat.
White lab coat. Check.
The best tasting cheddar on the planet is...
Time and time again.
Cabot Cheddar.
Check.
It looks like that was John, but I don't know. He's now disconnected. So what we're going to do is we're not going to be concerned with that because who knows, maybe he's taking a phone call or got an emergency, whatever the case is. In the meantime, I guess then what we'll do is we'll end up looking to see if we can cover some, you know, just a little bit more information about what's going on the world stage. Now let's quickly look here at some of the latest information. Bear with me a moment. Bear with me a moment here, because I didn't expect to start off here so quickly, but we'll find our footing in a moment. Okay. One second here. Ugh, this is just a joke. All right, what we're going to do is we're going to just go into our international news, and we'll try to cover that. Well, let's start off with what's going on first in the following. Bear with me a moment. Okay. One second. We're almost there. Okay, I think this will work. Okay. It seems evidently the rights groups are warning of a crackdown in the Kurdish area of Mahabad. This is what's happening in Iran. It seems the rights groups and a prominent cleric have warned of a military crackdown in the Kurdish city following intense protests there. Meanwhile, Iran arrested two actresses and its football captain spoke up at the World Cup. Kurdish rights groups and a prominent Sunni cleric, critical of Iran's government, on Sunday said that the regime had stepped up suppression of anti-government protests in the country's Kurdish region, deploying troops and killing four demonstrators on Sunday. While several people posted unverifiable images and videos online saying they showed Iranian military vehicles pouring into the western city of Mahabad. Well, the Norway-based human rights group HENGAW, H-E-N-G-A-W, said that military helicopters carried in members of the Revolutionary Guards to quell the protests in Mahabad, which were particularly intense earlier this week. HENGAW also said that Iranian forces opened fire in the town of Marivan. A prominent Sunni cleric by the name of Molavi Abdul Hamid, a powerful dissenting voice in Iran, called on security forces to refrain from shooting people in Mahabad. Quote, disturbing news is emerging from the Kurdish areas, especially from Mahabad. Pressure and crackdown will lead to further dissatisfaction, and officers should refrain from shooting at people, Abdul Hamid wrote on Twitter. HENGAW said that at least four protesters were killed in the Kurdish area. Another widely followed activist group spoke of a teacher and a 16-year-old girl being killed. Yet that could not be verified. Now, Iranian state media did refer to the unrest in Kurdish regions, but on Sunday only said that calm had been restored in the area. Well, Iranian strikes on Iraqi Kurdistan is condemned by the United States. So also on Sunday, authorities in Iraqi Kurdistan reported Iranian military strikes against Kurdish groups across the border that killed at least one person, events that could be linked to the unrest within Iran. Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps have again bombarded Iranian Kurdish parties. The Counterterrorism Department of Iraqi Kurdistan said, without mentioning if there were casualties. Well, the Democratic Party of Iranian Kurdistan, PDKI, that Iran had targeted it using missiles and drones in two places. One was Koya, another Jejnikan, near Erbil, the capital of Iraqi Kurdistan. These indiscriminate attacks are occurring at a time when the terrorist regime of Iran is unable to stop the ongoing demonstrations in Iranian Kurdistan, the PDKI wrote. The party told Kurdish news site Rudaw, R-U-D-A-W, that one of their members had been killed in a strike that targeted their headquarters. The news agency Agence France-Presse also reported the death. Now, another Iranian Kurdish nationalist group, Komala, K-O-M-A-L-A, made similar claims. Well, Iran blames such groups for fomenting unrest within its borders. U.S. Central Command, which oversees U.S. military operations in the Middle East, denounced the, quote, indiscriminate and illegal, end quote, strikes. Quote, we condemn this evening's Iranian cross-border missile and unmanned aerial vehicle strikes, end quote, CENTCOM Commander General Michael Kurilla said in a statement. Quote, such indiscriminate and illegal attacks place civilians at risk, violate Iraqi sovereignty, and jeopardize the hard-fought security and stability of Iraq and the Middle East, he added. Iranians, quote, do not buy into this narrative, quote, of
Kurdish separatism. The nationwide protests gripping Iran began with the death in custody of a young Kurdish woman by the name of Jinnah Mahsa Amini. The demonstrations have been most intense in the areas where the majority of Iran's 10 million Kurds live. In recent days, demonstrations in support of protesters in Mahabad have been seen elsewhere in the country. Kamran Mateen, a senior lecturer at the University of Sussex, advised that it showed how efforts by the Iranian regime to divide and rule in the country were failing. Quote, for decades, the Islamic Republic has invested in and actively promoted division between different nationalities and cultural regions and communities in Iran, Mateen had said, and, quote, Kurdistan has been particularly subject to this policy. Mateen said this was, quote, evidence that actually the people in other parts of Iran do not buy into this narrative of separatism, which is what the government is trying to propagate, that the Kurdish regions are dominated by separatist movements and these people want to disintegrate Iran. Well, despite that, we see that people immediately from Tehran to remote parts of Iran are coming out and expressing support for people of Mahabad who have come under intense military, conventional military troops of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Mateen had said. Well, two women actors have been arrested for not wearing a hijab. Despite Jinnah Mahsa Amini being Kurdish, the identity of the protest has centered much more around women's rights and civil liberties in general. Amini was arrested for not wearing a mandatory headscarf or hijab, and some of the earliest protests began with women demonstrably uncovering their hair in public settings. Her youth has also been a core feature of the movement, which has many roots in schools and universities. Iranian authorities on Sunday said that they had arrested two prominent female actors, one by the name of Hengameh Haziani and Katayun Riahi, for appearing in public without their headscarves. Haziani posted a video to Instagram captioned, quote, "This may be my last post. From here on, whatever happens, know that as always, I will stand with the people of Iran." In the video, she appears with her hair uncovered, without speaking, then turns her back to the camera and starts pulling her hair into a ponytail. Iran's captain speaks out in Qatar as the coach is questioned at home. Iranian media also reported on Sunday that eight celebrities and politicians were questioned about comments they had made about the protests, including the coach of one of Iran's best-known football teams. Yahya Holhamadi, the coach of Persepolis Football Club, had criticized Iran's national team for not, quote, bringing the voice of the oppressed people to the ears of the authorities, end quote. This came as the team met with President Ebrahim Raisi ahead of the World Cup in Qatar. On Sunday, Iran's captain did raise the issue. Ehsan Haj Safi said that Iran's players wanted to be the voice, quote, end quote, of the people back home. Quote, the situation in the country is not good and our people are not happy, Haj Safi had said. Iran plays England in their opening World Cup match on Monday. That's today. And other dissent has been logged in the sporting world. On Saturday, the head of Iran's Boxing Federation, Hossein Souri, said that he would not be returning from a tournament. I could no longer serve my dear country in a system that so easily sheds the blood of human beings, Souri had said. According to activist groups, Iran Human Rights at least 378 people have been killed in the protests nationwide in total, and 47 of them were children. Unbelievable, the atrocities that take place. Literally unbelievable. Bear with me a moment here. This is very, very interesting. Germany has offered Poland an air defense system. Seems Warsaw saw it received the offer of Eurofighters, said it received the offer of Eurofighters and Patriot defense missiles, quote, with satisfaction, end quote. It came a week after a Polish town bordering Ukraine was hit by missiles. German Defense Minister Christine Wambrecht said in remarks published on Monday that Berlin offered Eurofighters and Patriot defense missiles to Warsaw to help secure its airspace. Quote, we have to position ourselves in the alliance even better in terms of air defense, end quote, Wambrecht told the Rheinische Post and Generalanzeiger newspapers, adding that it was necessary, particularly for Poland, Slovakia, and the Baltic countries. Lambrecht noted that Slovakia was using these weapons for protection and added that Berlin sought to extend its presence there, quote, until the end of 2023, possibly even beyond, end quote. So what did Poland say? Poland's Defense Minister Mariusz Błaszczak said he received Berlin's offer, quote, with satisfaction, end quote. Błaszczak said he would suggest to the German side that the additional Patriot missile launcher be deployed close to the border with Ukraine. Question is, why now? Well, last week, a missile hit a grain depot in the Polish village of Przewodow, just 6 kilometers, it's about 4 miles from the Ukrainian border. The explosion killed 2 people in Poland and came on the same day that Russia fired a barrage of missiles across Ukraine. Polish and Western leaders have said that the missile was likely from Ukraine's air defense, although they maintained that the ultimate blame was on Russia for launching a war on Ukraine. Kyiv initially accused Russia of attacking the NATO country, and some Ukrainian experts went on this of the blast in Poland to help in the investigation. So it's very, very frightening what's going on here. Now let's look at some other issues here. Let's look at what's going on in Madagascar. There's so much happening around the world, and unfortunately, we too often don't have so much of this information here locally. Bear with me a moment as I try to reach onto that page. Okay, here we are. Well, they're digging for water in a Madagascar riverbed. It seems years of low rainfall in southern Madagascar, the island off the west coast of Africa, are creating a food crisis, the United Nations World Food Program has warned. The situation is particularly dire, and we'll just have to see what else happens there. Bear with me a moment. Check and see if this is coming through. 1 second here. Now, for some reason, I'm getting a stunted page. I don't know. Okay, let's look at what's happening here. Bear with me a moment as we try to cover this as well. Maybe there's some problem today with the internet. So, not quite sure. But we are definitely on the Blog Talk Radio platform, so looks like that's okay. Well, a new era for Kazakhstan's re-elected president. That's the question. Almost a year after violent mass protests in Kazakhstan, the country has re-elected its incumbent president, Hasim Yomart Tokayev. He has distanced himself from his predecessor and promised reforms. In January, images of Kazakhstan made headlines around the world. More than 200 people were killed in the Central Asian Republic, with nationwide protests over sudden increases in the price of liquid petroleum gas turned violent. Hasim Yomart Tokayev's hold on power seemed to be weakening. He declared a state of emergency and took the unprecedented step of asking the post-Soviet Collective Security Treaty Organization, Russia in particular, to send in troops. Foreign soldiers stayed only a few days, and Tokayev regained control over the country. Now, less than a year later, the 69-year-old Tokayev has emerged as victor after an early presidential election. According to the country's Electoral Commission, he received 81% of the vote in Sunday's election. However, his critics have pointed out that he did not have much competition. Well, he's distancing himself from Nazarbayev. The protests marked a turning point for Kazakhstan and also for Tokayev, who was able to extend his hold on power. His once powerful predecessor, Nursultan Nazarbayev, the country's first president, who was in charge for decades, was dismissed from his post as chairman of the Security Council earlier this year. He also lost the influence that, as a major political figure, he had continued to exert in the background. And this despite the fact that Tokayev owes his position to Nazarbayev. The latter resigned from office unexpectedly in 2019. It was an unusual move in Central Asia, where authoritarian rulers rarely relinquish power voluntarily during their lifetimes. Tokayev, who was chair of the Senate at the time, became president, and at his suggestion, the capital, Astana, was renamed Nur Sultan in Nazarbayev's honor. In September, however, Tokayev had a change of heart and reinstated the old name, Astana. This was another indication that he was seeking to distance himself from Nazarbayev, whose name he hardly mentioned anymore when he appears in public. One of the former president's nephews has been convicted of corruption and sentenced to 6 years in a penal colony. And there have been other prominent arrests, including that of former intelligence chief Karim Masimov. However, neither Nazarbayev himself nor his closest relatives have been prosecuted. The promises of reform. Well, it seems Tokayev has promised political and economic reforms in a state that listens. Observers see this as a reaction to the January protests and an attempt to improve his popularity ratings. Tokayev is considered to be less popular than Nazarbayev was once. In June, Tokayev called a referendum to confirm constitutional amendments that, among other things, strengthen parliament. Early parliamentary elections are due to be held in 2023. The president's power has also been curtailed. The term of office has been extended for 5 to 7 years, but there is no longer a provision for re-election. People in opposition parties have said that Tokayev is still very much under the influence of the Nazarbayev family, and some suggest that there could be new protests. Well, it's possible, because the former president's supporters are not passive. They're doing everything they can to try and regain their former power. They would like a repeat of the protest to chase Tokayev out of office. Bigeldi Gabdulin, the former editor-in-chief of the Central Asia Monitor newspaper, advised that Gabdulin spent 2 months in detention under Nazarbayev after reporting critically on state officials. He believes Tokayev will go on to tackle reforms now that he has been reelected. So what about Putin?
yet the current president of Kazakhstan has been part of the country's political elite for many years. He has previously served as prime minister and state secretary, among other positions. Saidahmat Kutikadam, a member of a presidential advisory council, said the January protests had considerably changed Tokayev. He predicts a government reshuffle, which he said the president needs, as he is trying to distance himself not only from Nazarbayev, but also from Russian President Vladimir Putin. Experts regard Tokayev's appearance at the International Economic Forum in St. Petersburg in June as an indication of this intent. The Kazakh president said then, in Putin's presence, that unlike Russia, his country would not recognize the separatist, quote, People's Republics of Donetsk and Luhansk. He referred to them as quasi-state territories, quote unquote. This was a different tone to the one he took 3 years ago when he refused in an interview with Deutsche Welle to describe Russia's de facto occupation of Crimea as an annexation. Quote, annexation is too strong a word for what has happened in Crimea, Tokayev said at the time, stressing that his country had, quote, friendly, neighborly relations of absolute trust with Russia. Fact is that Kazakhstan remains one of Moscow's closest allies in the Eurasian Economic Union. However, thanks to its abundance of raw materials, the country is less dependent on Moscow than, for example, Belarus, Kazakh, and political scientist Dunbar. Hold on a second, because, again, I'm getting calls at times when I'm not supposed to be able to answer them. Unbelievable. 1 second. Hopefully I'll be able to get this in time. And see where we go from here. 1 second. Okay, it looks like, yeah. But some sort of delivery of some sort is coming in. I'm really sorry for the interruption. Well, I'm waiting for the delivery. We'll see 1 second what goes on. Okay, hopefully we won't get disconnected, because that's really important. All right, so hopefully it'll be coming up soon. I'm in a very tall building, so sometimes, and I think that both elevators are now working. One of them had not been working for about a week. I think they're here now, so bear with me a second. Hello?
Hi.
Hi. Thanks so much. I appreciate you coming in today. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Be well. Thank you. And happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. So let me get back to broadcast. Again, my apology. Oh, God. All right, let's see if we can put all this together. All right, well, the secret is not to get sick, especially when you're old. And that, unfortunately, defines me. So bear with me a second as I get into this routine, pull up everything that we had before. Okay, so I think that we're good on this so far. Now, let me just see if we've covered this story. Okay. All right. So I think we're fine on this story with Tokayev, and we'll see where all this goes. Bear with me one more second. Okay. All right, now let's just see if we've got everything else in place. One second here. All right. Oh, one thing you should note, there is going to be a meeting, one at the Will Library and another on the east side of the city. And the one at the Will Library, which I will be attending, is going to begin, I think, at 6:30, and they're going to be discussing, not exactly sure who will be there to with regard to the discussion, but it has to do with term limits. And so we'll have to see what that's going to be like, and we'll go from there. So that's a story there. Move on to some other stories that we were trying to cover before the interruption, and we'll see if we can get there. Bear with me a second. This, I think you'll find interesting. Spain's got new recycling rules, which are expected to launch a war on waste. Well, garbage will now be the exception, recycling the rule. However, Spain needs to make a lot of changes in order for this to happen. Quote, you can have tap water, yes, but it tastes really bad, end quote, said the server at the trendy Veles et Vent restaurant in the Valencia Marina. Seems customers increasingly ask for tap water these days, but he has been instructed by his boss to warn them that it's unhealthy. Passed in April, a new law governing the disposal of waste in Spain will come into full effect in 2023. Restaurants are now required to provide customers with tap water for free in order to reduce waste from plastic bottle waters or plastic water bottles. But there's a big gap between the aspiration and the reality, said Borja Mateo, who works for the INESCOP Footwear Research Center in Alicante, where he runs a small recycling factory. And it's true that here too, you can taste the chemicals in the tap water. The European Union has repeatedly reprimanded Spain, warning that its water treatment processes are inadequate. Well, there's very little recycling. Spain is the fifth largest producer of single-use bottles in the European Union, according to Greenpeace, and very few of them are recycled. The Global Waste Index 2022 found that Germany produces much more waste than Spain, 632 kilograms, that's about 1,400 pounds, versus 455 kilos per capita. So that's a big difference, but that half of this waste is recycled, whereas Spain's recycling quota only amounts to 86 kilograms per person. A new tax is being imposed on single-use plastic containers and another on waste sent to landfills or for incineration. The aim is to help Spain reduce the amount of refuse it generates to 15% of its 2010 level by 2030. The new waste law also bans the marketing of single-use plastic products as well as cosmetic products and detergents containing microplastics, and limits the destruction or disposal of unsold, unperishable products, including textiles, toys, or electrical appliances, said Mai Lopez, sustainability expert at the EAE Business School of Madrid. Well, it's a challenge for Spain's economy. Parliamentary elections are scheduled for next autumn, and things are not looking good for Socialist Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez, especially with businesses complaining about regulations and taxes. Many Spaniards, including the opposition, have expressed skepticism about the law. Isabel Díaz Ayuso, the conservative head of the regional government in Madrid,
recently likened Sanchez's policy to sectarianism and communism. The environmental movement is not strong in Spain. Nonetheless, the new law stipulates that restaurants and supermarkets must reduce their waste to a minimum. Leftover food must either be donated or processed into animal feed. Restaurant patrons have the right to ask for their child's uneaten dinner to be packed up to take home. But we still don't have the infrastructure to support some of these systems, said Mateo. Germany, for example, Spain doesn't have a universal deposit system for drink bottles. The problem is apparent when you walk into Mateo's recycling factory. A machine is chopping up old shoes into tiny pieces. As it does, it sorts out valuable elements such as buttons and wires. Otherwise, in Spain, they just end up in landfill, even though they contain a lot of valuable material, Mateo had said. Spain is also home to two giants of the fast fashion industry, Inditex and Mango. Primark, Bershka, Mango, Zara, and Stradivarius sit side by side on the Gran Via shopping street in Madrid. Every day, young people line up to buy T-shirts and jackets at knockdown prices. A few months later, many of these items are simply thrown away street, and hardly anyone is interested in giving them a new life. Second-hand clothing and flea markets are not common in Spain. Although many people talk about sustainability, Mateo said few have fully considered what it means. In this respect, he is an admirer of German attitudes toward the environment. Spanish pharmacies, for example, wrap boxes of medicine in paper and put them in a bottle, in a bag before handing them to the customer. When a customer declined the extra packaging to put the box straight into her bag, the saleswoman looked surprised. On a recent Thursday evening, teenagers partied on a children's playground in Madrid, a popular though unauthorized spot. There's a fine of up to $2,070 for littering, but the police patrol ignores them. When the teens go home, they leave cigarette butts, beer cans, and plastic packaging scattered on the ground. By the following morning, everything is clean again, and the general population is not particularly bothered. Well, the streets of downtown Madrid are swept first thing in the morning. The garbage collectors are out at midnight, and cleaning crews pick up the trash left behind in the parks, while leaf blowers roar along the paths surrounded by the stench of diesel. Spanish cities are undoubtedly cleaner than many German ones, but there's a price for this. The newspaper El Diario has calculated that the cost of garbage collection and city cleaning services in Madrid is now 70% higher than before the pandemic. It's going to take a lot more time to educate Spanish society, said Borja Mateo. That's part some of the reality. Unbelievable. Now, let's just look at some other things which you may find interesting. Let's look at this. The World Cup 2022 football, or soccer as we know it here in the United States, begins in Qatar. The future of football, or soccer as we understand it in America, arrived in the present as the much maligned 2022 World Cup in Qatar began. Camels and Hollywood star Morgan Freeman took part in an opening ceremony with a not-so-soft. It is happening then. The 2022 World Cup in Qatar is underway. Qatar lost to Ecuador 2-0 in the opener on Sunday, and making more unwanted headlines by becoming the first host to lose the opening game in the tournament's history. The opening ceremony might not have topped FIFA president Gianni Infantino's Shakespearean-like monologue the day before, but there was certainly an argument that it topped the football that followed it. short as opening ceremonies go. Qatar balanced crowd-pleasing nostalgia with loud entertainment. It also included plenty of reminders just in case previous mentions had been forgotten. Tournament is about bringing people together. Indeed, the opening game brought together a select band of very, very important people, very, very important people, Infantino, Qatar's Emir Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani, and Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Also in attendance were International Olympic Committee President Thomas Bach and Nasser Al-Khelaifi, head of the European Club Association. But this controversy cost in criticism. There was also camels. There were also camels. Hollywood star Morgan Freeman, the need for respect and tolerance, and K-pop star Jungkook of BTS singing about realizing dreams. The integration of different nations' chants into one melody and the return of all the previous World Cup mascots were, even if a classic of the opening ceremony genre, nice touches of the aforementioned nostalgia. It was a celebration, but the message behind it was also hard to miss. Indeed, when Sheikh Hamad bin Khalifa Al Thani, father of Qatar's current emir, was played clips of his own football memories or soccer memories, the audience was invited to join in recalling its own soccer origin story. Well, given the controversy, cost, and criticism of this tournament, together might not be the most fitting word. Nevertheless, from the Souq Waqif, a redevelopment marketplace in Doha that has become a hub for fans, to the tent-like structure of the Al Bayt Stadium, there were plenty of football fans, jerseys and colors of Poland, Ghana, Brazil, Argentina, and Mexico were all on display. While Qatar's cheering section felt a bit more choreographed, the use of the Icelandic clap inside the opening 2 minutes, a little too well studied perhaps, Ecuador's yellow corner was tremendous and vibrant. The future is here. Real passion, some fans have presented, this World Cup also feels unsettingly staged. The Al Bayt Stadium lies a 40-minute drive north of Doha, the capital. To get there, many fans arrive by the self-driving metro and then a bus, a million-dollar service built specifically for this tournament. Riding the glossy train felt like a scene from a science fiction film where the creator reveals their grand plans for the future. This is the present. This $200 billion World Cup in the smallest ever host nation is happening now. The lights and music are on. An enormous inflatable World Cup trophy was put on the center circle and flames were fired off into the air around it. Other than the large yellow section of Ecuador fans, some of whom sang for beer, the stadium really was half empty. 15 minutes before the final whistle, the show, as it always does in football, goes on. Indeed, Infantino said as much just before the game began. Welcome to celebrate football because football unites the world. Let's welcome the teams and let the show begin. And so the tournament that many believe has already changed football forever. Football is in focus, but it is unlikely to remain the focus for the next month. So that's what's going on there. Now let's look at some other things. Bear with me a moment. One second. All right.
You might find this interesting. This is about Germany. Bear with me a second here. Berlin reopens Friedrichstrasse Boulevard to cars. Berlin will allow cars back onto a pedestrianized stretch of Berlin's Friedrichstrasse shopping street, although experts warn that Germany could miss its 2030 climate targets. So what's behind the U-turn? It's a sunny yet chilly weekday afternoon in November, and the northern half of Berlin's Friedrichstrasse Boulevard is bustling with shoppers and workers on their lunch breaks. The 1.8-mile or 3-kilometer-long road running north to south through Berlin's so-called government district is known for its chic stores, upscale hotels and restaurants. It's a tourist magnet, too. Passing by the city's famous Cold War-era Checkpoint Charlie border crossing and other historical attractions, what better place to prioritize cyclists and pedestrians, Berlin authorities thought in August of 2020. Consequently, closing off a short stretch of Friedrichstrasse to automobiles. Regina Günther, that's Berlin's traffic commissioner at the time, banished cars from a 500-meter, that's about a 1,640-foot section of the shopping boulevard, had makeshift cycle lanes marked out in the middle of the road, and got city workers to set up benches and plant pots along the curbs. The initial plan was to keep the section closed to cars until October of 2021 as part of an urban traffic experiment. When the authorities extended the restrictions for another year to preserve the positive aspects of the experiment, however, local wine dealer Anja Schröder took legal action to have the road reopened to cars and won. She said the closure was bad for businesses. So what went wrong? The U-turn has left many scratching their heads, particularly given the precarious state of Germany's climate goals. The federal government has pledged to cut greenhouse gas emission by at least 65% by 2030 compared to 1990 levels. But an expert committee convened by the government warned earlier this month that Germany is in serious danger of not meeting its 2030 targets. Examples of successful car-free shopping zones in other German and European cities, such as Hamburg's Spitalstraße pedestrian zone or Bordeaux's Rue Saint-Catherine shopping street, have also shown that pedestrian streets can benefit local businesses. Experience shows that when streets are pedestrianized, revenue increases. Wolf Holger Amt of Berlin's Technical University advised, the urban researcher said that Berlin has been far too timid and slow in pushing automobiles out of the inner city and or city center, blaming authorities for their car-centric worldview. While he welcomed the partial and, in his view, overdue, quote-unquote, closure of Friedrichstrasse to cars, he also said it was poorly implemented, a view that's echoed by many who work or live on or near Friedrichstrasse. Some 20 shops in the area closed since the street was closed to cars, said Konrad Ausch of the Die Mitte, an organization that represents local residents and businesses. He does, however, admit that previous coronavirus-related restrictions also adversely impacted business. A clear causality is therefore difficult to establish. And again, die Mitte means the middle in German. Ben, 22-year-old student from Bulgaria, he's waiting at the traffic lights near the top end of the closed-off stretch of Friedrichstrasse. He said he would have preferred to see it remain a pedestrian zone, quote, but I just think it was implemented a little
offhandedly, he said, "I don't really like the fact that they have given the majority of space to cyclists. There could have been more benches and more trees." Still, he very much supports the idea of pedestrianized shopping streets, citing the one in his hometown of Plovdiv as a positive example. Now, David Mojarad, 51, is sitting further along the car-free stretch of Friedrichstrasse, enjoying a coffee, taking in the cyclists whizzing past the eerily quiet Russian Cultural Center and uninviting makeshift benches on the opposite side of the road. Mojarad works and lives nearby. Well, this section of Friedrichstrasse is awful, and I'm practically looking forward to the return of cars, said Mojarad. He too said this urban space should have been designed with much greater attention to detail, more trees, and a different cycle path. The partial closure of Friedrichstrasse to cars was an opportunity, Ragnhild Sorensen of Changing Cities advised. The organization wants to redesign German cities in the interest of pedestrians and cyclists. She said, while Berlin invested too little money and effort into the plowing cars back is, quote, absurd in light of the climate crisis. So what could Berlin have done differently? Well, one possible inspiration for Berlin could have been Vienna's Maria Hilferstrasse. For decades, the popular shopping street in Austria's capital-heavy car traffic and even more frequent traffic jams. Then in August of 2015, bear with me a second, Maria Hilferstrasse was pedestrianized, yet crucially, and unlike in Berlin, locals were invited to have their say and vote on the planned measure, with 53.2% of participants ultimately backing the transformation. While not everyone welcomed the change initially, over time, many businesses and locals warmed to the new situation. It has been such a success that shopkeepers from other streets are now approaching Vienna City Council, saying they want their roads closed off to cars too, said Arndt of Berlin's Technical University. Not everyone changed. Edgar Terlinden, a political spokesperson for the Berlin branch of Germany's Motoring Association, ADAC, opposes measures aimed at curbing car traffic along Berlin's Friedrichstrasse or elsewhere in the city. Berlin's existing urban structure should not be radically altered, argues. For examples, like Vienna's Maria Hilferstrasse show that urban change can be successful if properly planned. And this success also depends on how we talk about and envision such change, said Sorensen. It's a major problem that urban change is always framed as something negative, she said. We need to tell people how things could be, painting a picture of what it could look like. If that doesn't happen, there will be no change in mentality. And this was important for you to hear, for those listening, because what's really compelling about all this is the fact that we need to do something similar to what they're doing in Austria and in Berlin, because I think that New York City requires that. The traffic is unbelievable. Maybe they should only be permitted for buses on certain routes, but then it seems like every avenue in Manhattan is a shopping center of some sort. Of course, Fifth Avenue is the most prestigious, Madison Avenue as well, and so on and so forth. So there needs to be some sort of a plan on how this needs to be done, but it hasn't yet been formulated, and that is the shame of it all. So What can I tell you? Now let's just quickly look because other things are happening. We only have about three and a half minutes or so before we speak to Ron Matten. Yes, Ron Matten's coming on. He's a Republican politician from Yonkers. He's going to speak to some of the upcoming discussions that are going to be conducted at the Yonkers Larkin Plaza Library, as well as the Will Library on the east side of the city. Then there are term limits that are being extended. We'll see what topics he wants to cover, and we'll go from there. So bear with me a second. We've only got like about 3 minutes left. Let me quickly look and see what else we've got here that might be of interest. Bear with me a moment for the last few minutes. One second here. One sec. No, I think... Well, just in case you didn't know, as if it's going to make a big difference in your life, there's evidence of cooking 780,000 years ago, which is rewriting human history. It seems that Homo erectus was cooking fish 780,000 years ago, boosting brain growth of early humans. Now, that is fascinating, to say the least. So let me just quickly see. So a new study shows that early humans were cooking much further back in history than previously thought. Nutrients required for brain growth may have come from cooked fish. So when we first learned to cook food is one of the most important evolutionary moments of our species. It's what transformed us into modern humans. So around 1 to 2 million years ago, early humans developed taller bodies and bigger brains. And the thinking is that calorie-rich diets and cooking in particular drove this change, said David Braun. He's a professor of anthropology at Columbian College of Arts and Sciences in Washington, D.C., not to be confused with Columbia College. So a new study published in Nature, Ecology, and Evolution suggests that early humans first food around 780,000 years ago. Before now, the earliest evidence of cooked food was around 70,000 years ago, with early Homo sapiens and Neanderthals using the fire to cook vegetables and meat. The first cooking fires predate Homo sapiens. The new study shows that Homo erectus, an ancestor of modern humans, was cooking food much further back in history. Setting this date back by more than 600,000 years has implications for reconstructing the evolutionary history of ancient humans. The study author, Jens Nyorka, from the Natural History Museum of London, advised. The study team found their evidence in an archaeological site located in the northern Jordan Valley in modern-day Israel. The site called Geshel Benot Yaakov is known to date back to around 780,000 years ago. So last paragraph, it is believed that Homo erectus communities of the so-called Acheulean culture lived in the region. The communities had a varied diet, including large game, fruit and vegetables, and freshwater fish from the nearby Paleo Lake Hula. Until now, experts didn't know if they ate their food raw or cooked. Very, very exciting. Certainly knowledgeable and very interesting. I see that Mr. Matten is already on the line, so let's welcome. He's a Republican politician from the city of Yonkers. Good morning for your patience hanging in there on the line. How are you, sir?
Good morning, Hezzy. How are you this morning?
Thank goodness, really okay. I'm really thrilled. Today's going to be a big day. I didn't learn until very, very late last night that there was going to be a meeting at both libraries, the Will and the Riverfront Library, and there's going to be discussion there. I think at 6:30 in the Riverfront Library, and they're going to talk about term limits and stuff. But there's some people that are for term limits, and there are other people that are against term limits. So they're going to vote on it on Tuesday, the city council. So there it is. What topics do you think are most important to think about?
Well, you know, so one thing, I think this vote is highly rushed. I think this vote is highly rushed. It was presented in rules last week. Should have gone to legislation, and then come out of legislation and then been voted on. So
I concur with you, to be honest with you, because what I recognized at the end was there are some members of the city council. Well, the mechanism I thought that would be engaged for extending term limits for the mayor, and I thought it was going to be exclusive to the mayor, was going to be, well, bear with me a second. I just took my pills, so I'm losing my mind already. Yes, the term
You'll
limits.
You'll have to share some of those
term
pills.
Limits,
then,
oh yeah, well, you know, sometimes they're worthwhile, so you don't you remember nothing. But it turns out that the term limits. Oh yes, the mayor served 12 years, but the mayor has said that he would be interested in running for a fourth 4-year term. And I thought there would be a referendum to that end, but it didn't happen. So now I understand there's going to be a vote on Tuesday by the Yonkers City Council membership. There are 7 members.
Yeah.
But
so
some
I,
of those members of the city council, they are precluded from running for another term. So
well,
I find
there's
that
only one. There's only one right now that is precluded, which is Mike Green, who would be
okay.
term limited out next year. The others,
well, then,
I think, and Carazone would be term limited on her next term. But, you know, obviously her next term is not up for another 2 years. So she's,
uh-huh.
you know, those are the two
so then,
that would benefit
so should,
from
so,
this
should
decision.
Should Breen be allowed to vote if he's not, because isn't he conflicted to vote for an extension of the city council membership for themselves?
No, because they can do that.
No.
No, they.
Well, they
under
don't need
municipal,
his vote. And they
well,
don't
they
need
do need
his
vote. They do need his vote because without his vote, they're tied. And
because of those people that might support extension of the term limits. Oh, I didn't realize that. Okay.
Yeah, so they
not everyone's on board.
Well, so at the last, I was at the Tuesday night council meeting for rules, and there seemed to have been a little confusion around Shanae Williams, who voted to move the motion forward, but then claimed she didn't realize what she was doing. And basically wanted to take back her vote. And I don't recall whether the gavel was down or not. I think Anthony Moranti was putting in an amendment to the motion, so I don't know if the gavel was fully down. I believe we follow Robert's rules. So, you know, shame on me. I didn't pay attention that closely. I was sitting about 4 rows back in a packed room. But I was surprised that this is being ramrodded through. So I expect nothing else than those of council people have already made up their mind, and the motion will pass. Regardless of how many people show up tonight, the motion will pass. And I don't know how can they have two simultaneous meetings and the council actually get proper feedback?
I don't know.
But, you know, because usually the council sits together, and is it really a council meeting if they divide the council up and there's no quorum? I don't see how this would work.
I have no idea. I have no idea. So I didn't realize that there was going to be a meeting at the library, so I was able to arrange for to be driven there. So I will go to the Will Library, not to the Will, to the Riverfront Library to attend the meeting. It'll be very interesting to see what the public has to say or what some of the politicians will have to say. But there will be a vote on Tuesday, term limits.
Right.
And so we'll see what that will finalize.
So the council has the right to do this based on the city charter. And based on New York State law, Article 2, Section 10 of Municipal Home Rule, general powers of local governments to adopt and amend local laws. And basically, it states, a county, city, town, or village has the powers, duties, qualifications, number, mode of selection, removal, terms of office, compensation, hours of work, protection, welfare, safety of its officers, employees, except that cities and towns shall not have the power with respect to members of the legislative body of the county in their capacities as county officers. So basically, New York State law allows them to do this. The law that I recall was drafted by John Murtaugh allows them to do this as well, because there's nothing in that law that states it must be done by referendum.
Well, you know what I think I find disturbing is that when the term limits were set to a maximum of two terms, the city council would have been there, and when they retired, they would get one amount as their pension, you know, for doing their duty for the city. But if they're going to extend term limits, they're going to even get greater return on their pension. And
yeah, I'm not sure how
the city have the means.
I'm not sure exactly how the pension formula works, and the pension is changed based on what tier you're on. So, for instance, when I was a state employee, I came late. I was in tier six. Tier six, which I think these folks all fall under, unless they were employed by a municipality earlier. Tier six requires that you do 10 years of service. So when the term limits were expanded to 12 years, allowing 12 years, they were able to then all qualify. And again, it's based, there's a formula, I don't recall it entirely, but it's based on your years of service and how much you make. And the council doesn't make a lot of money, not compared to others. And then you're capped out.
But don't they earn about $100,000 worth of money, and including benefits?
It doesn't include your
free
benefits.
Car.
Well,
they get
it
a free car, they get
free
gas.
So the standard council members make about $50,000 a year. Then I know that Mike Breen is minority leader, gets a stipend for that. Tasha Diaz is majority leader, gets a stipend. Then they gave John Rubo a phony title of minority whip. Majority whip. So he gets a stipend for that. So that's maybe it's $60,000 for the folks with the stipend, and then the council president gets $80,000 and change. But it's that dollar amount that the pension is based on, not any additional benefit. And there's a portion, it's very little because they make so little. There's a portion they have to put in to their they have to in tier six. They have to contribute to their pension as well. It's a small portion. And again, when you're making, let's say, $160,000 a year, it's a larger portion It's a percentage of what you make. I think at 160, it might be 5%, but they do a 3-year look back. So they don't start charging you that that additional percent based on the average salary of the last 3 years. So let's say, for instance, I think they will generally get somewhere in the neighborhood of $1,800 to $2,000 as their pension for the rest of their life at their retirement date. Plus, I think they also get benefits, which is a big one. The bigger thing is I'd rather have benefits when I retire than have the pension amount, because that's a bigger amount of money.
But the real issue is, if we're extending term limits, are they going to advise the public that it's going to cost them so much more money in pension and benefits? Because nobody planned on such a long term. These people, most people lived into their 70s and 80s even.
Yeah,
taxpayer paid.
It's a little bit of a zero.
Taxpayers hide.
It's a little bit of a zero-sum game, because you have a new person coming in accruing that. So I don't know if it's that large amount. But, you know, in anything, yes, the council is enriching themselves. You know, I don't find anyone, you know, I don't find many, let's say anyone, because I don't want to speak in absolutes. There aren't many on the council who are really equipped. They don't have the capacity. I'm going to use one of your words. They don't really have the capacity to serve the people. And in large respect, they're acting in their own interests in this. Going out and giving food out, that's not a council's. I have great respect.
I resent it, actually, because infuse their name in relationship to the food, which is donated and given to them to distribute.
The food would happen whether they're there or not. The food would happen whether they're there or not.
The reason I'm mostly offended, too, is that, if anything, we've got houses of worship in the city of Yonkers, whatever religious background you have, why doesn't it go to them? Because that's where people will congregate. And there are many people that would go to the house of worship, whatever they ascribe to. And even those that don't frequent the house of worship would still be made aware of it.
Right. So
it makes no sense why a politician should take credit for this.
The narrative has changed. I believe some of the politicians have been called on it. There was one politician who was out there claiming to be a board member or have her own nonprofit for this. I don't know if that's true. This is the problem. Politicians take credit for everything. And I'm going to say that all of these advances in the city really come from the mayor. Not the free food, but unless a council person has cooperation of the mayor, they're not getting things for their district. And that's not to say that's wrong, because that's the same way it works at the
everywhere.
State. You know, if somebody is at odds with Cuomo, they weren't getting anything.
Yeah.
I don't know if the same holds true for Hochul at this point. If you look way back to when Rudy Giuliani was mayor of New York City, Mario Cuomo was being challenged by George Pataki, and Giuliani looked at the tea leaves and he supported Mario Cuomo.
Yeah.
Because he thought Mario Cuomo, the Republican Rudy Giuliani, thought Mario Cuomo would win, and he endorsed Mario Cuomo because he thought it was best for the city.
Unbelievable.
It didn't work out for Mario Cuomo. He lost. George Pataki won. And Rudy Giuliani had a very strained relationship with George Pataki throughout their shared tenure elected officials. So, you know, the council needs to appease the mayor for many things, because they under the charter, the council does not have any authority over any of the commissioners. They all report to the mayor. If the council wants something done, they go to constituent services, just like you and I would.
Right.
Certainly, they get a little more, you know, but they have a better voice, because they should know what their districts need most. So it's up to the council to prioritize what they need in their districts.
Yeah.
The council have some tools if they want to make sure their districts are being adequately supported by the administration. You certainly can look at the dollar amount that goes to each district, say from DPW, say from Parks Department, and all of these others, and put that in a per capita formula and figure out if the third council district is being equally treated like the fifth council district.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if I were on the council, that's how I would gauge as to whether or not my constituents are getting proper service from the city.
Yeah.
So
I don't know if the different districts get an equal amount.
I don't know either.
No,
you know, you're supposed to have roughly the same pot. You know, again, we're going through redistricting now, so this is the time when those things get moved around. Then you need to have roughly the same population within each district. I think it's within 5%, so plus or minus 2.5%. Excuse me, within each district. To the median number of people in the city, divided by six, because you're dealing with six council districts. You take that median plus or minus 2.5%, and that tells you whether your district is over or underpopulated and where they have to move the lines. So that's what they're they've wasted their time doing that on ward apportionment right now. Ward apportionment means nothing. Ward apportionment is nothing more than a political animal. The wards are something Yonkers has from way back. We used to have 12 council people.
I remember reading about that.
We had 12 and a council president versus six, and they combined the wards. But then the council had a lot of power, and the mayor had very little power. That's back in the strong council days. And that was the Hank Spallone days and everything else before the charter was revised. But you know, so right now, I don't know that the council districts are spent equally or not. You know, that would be a great exercise to just see which council people may have favorite status and where their alignment or disalignment is with the administration.
That would be very interesting just to see where things are. It's up to the individual council members to define what they get and what others get. And then I guess at that point, if they can get a balanced deal of equal value as all the other districts. Very, very interesting. Are we coming to a different stage in our political demeanor in Yonkers? The mayor may run for a fourth four-year term, which was unexpected by many. And
I'm glad you clarified the last statement, unexpected by many, but probably not unexpected.
It shouldn't have been unexpected. You're right.
I'm not fully opposed to town limits. You know, we voted every election. You know, Ed Koch, who was a popular mayor when he started, you know, by the time he ran for a fourth term, his popularity waned.
Yes, it did.
And he wasn't reelected. And he lost his primary, as a matter of fact. So I mean, he had some other things going on with Madison Queens, and there was a suicide, and there was some accusations of things going on that Koch had no part in. They felt that as the mayor, he should have known, and they were all within his party.
Well, I have to agree with you when it comes to Mayor Spano. Certainly, he's at the top of his game. He's accomplished a great deal in the last 12 years. I don't think anyone else has been able to do what he's done.
I have
and
no
nobody
reservation.
Else is qualified.
Well, I would
anybody
say,
else
so,
could, really?
There might not be anybody else
I don't
else
know
who's
if anybody
qualified.
Else that comes anywhere near him.
There might
Sorry.
Not be anybody else that's qualified who can also get elected. Like I will say that there are people that are qualified out there, but I don't know their capacity to get elected.
Well, there are other people that are thinking of running, but they don't have the financial means to challenge this mayor.
What I will say is that the ability to get elected is not a qualification to do the job.
Correct.
So there are people that are qualified. Are there people that are qualified and able to get elected? Well, that might depend on how willing people are to dip into their own funds for this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the mayor has a tremendous ability of fundraising. Look, you know, and it's not just the mayor. You know, there's a team behind the mayor, and it's not the team is not necessarily all sitting in City Hall. You know, the mayor's brother Nick has a background in politics.
Mm-hmm.
He's a lobbyist.
Mm-hmm.
He knows people. I don't think the mayor got Lionsgate to come to Yonkers all on his own. I'm sure there was some. There was major support from his family to make that happen. Wilson Kimball and Jim Cavanaugh are also a part of the mayor's team who have other
mm-hmm.
connections within government. So you know the mayor's had 12 years to build his well-oiled machine. You know, we didn't look as good in 2016 as we do now. You know, we didn't look, you know, earlier than that, we had bargaining unit contracts that were coming due. We had a fiasco on the school side with book revenue
mm-hmm.
that wasn't there. You know, the city was a little bit of a disorganized in the early Spano years.
Yeah.
I would say it took until 2016 that the Spano machine started firing on all cylinders. So
correct.
Maybe that's why some people are not anxious to see him go. And I'm not saying I want him gone either. I would have liked to have seen this. I would have liked to have seen a referendum put forward that would have been on the ballot
mm-hmm.
this past November. You know,
that would have been a
smarter
way to go.
You know, everyone could have had
I'm wondering,
a
though,
say.
If there could be you think there could be a challenge to the city council voting for
its
term
limits? I think this is covered by New York State Home Municipal Rule Law, and it's also
uh-huh.
covered within our own charter. And if there was an opportunity to challenge it, I think people would have done it 4 years ago. You know, certainly, you know, there are those who want to run, who actually still have a fair amount of money in their account and have some ability to
mm-hmm.
raise money. Mike Cater, for example, who I think has absolutely no chance of winning,
mm-hmm.
still has about $120,000 in his campaign account as we speak.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think he has the capacity to probably raise another $120,000 before campaigning starts next year.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he's got the money to challenge the mayor. I just think with his legal problems, he doesn't have the ability.
I just don't think that he's thought of in a credible way.
Well, I think you're right. You know, I think his loss to Lakeisha Collins Bellamy. You know, I guess he didn't think he was in a real race. I don't know, but that loss.
Who knows?
I mean, there's claims of dirty tricks and all that, but even with that, it's politics at the end of the day, and I don't see, you know, why he didn't go out and get himself a third-party line, as I did, as Anthony Moranti did, and even Lakeisha, who had the Working Families Party line, to guarantee that you would be on that ballot in November. So,
That's a very good point.
So I think there was a little bit of
strategic perspective.
Or maybe he got bad advice. Maybe he got bad advice from the people who were handling his campaign. Because if you recall, the people who were handling his campaign, they switched to a different candidate midstream.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's going to be an interesting year next year. You know, as I said, I'm pretty sure the votes are all ready to give the mayor another term, regardless of tonight's meeting.
Think so.
Yeah, I don't. Lakeisha's pretty bright. I don't think she would have put this legislation forward if she wasn't sure she had the votes.
That's a good point. I didn't really think about that, but I think you're right about that as well.
Right. So I think that she knows she's got the votes. Otherwise, the legislation would have waited till next month. But I think she knows she's got the votes. This is just a formality where people are going to go to. I'm not attending tonight because I just, you know, my voice isn't going to make a difference. But, you know, I think it's therapeutic for people to get up and say how they feel. So they can wait around for 4 hours to speak and get it all off their chest, whichever way they feel about the this legislation.
And you're talking about the meetings at the library.
The meetings at the library. It's going to be it's more of a therapeutic session than accomplishing anything else.
Yeah, because I really wonder what's going to come out of that meeting tonight at the library. I think it's just people mouthing off and giving expression to what they believe.
You'll have a lot of people on both sides. At the end of the day, the council will vote the way the council will vote, and they will tell people that you had a chance to speak. And we listened to everybody. You know, the speeches were impactful, and then we made our decisions. So it's going to be great theater.
Yes, that's what it will be. The real drama will be on Tuesday.
And then we'll see how this impacts the council, the members of the council. Look, I was at the meeting on Tuesday last week, and Westchester Black Women's Political Caucus, I was sitting amongst the Westchester Black Women's Political Caucus, and they seemed very upset that this decision was moving out of committee. So there are, and I believe the NAACP also made a statement that they were upset that this was moving forward. So there are those traditional groups that have supported folks on the council that are voting in favor of this. And we'll have to see how that looks next year for certain council people, whether they get a primary. Even the Republican Party. The Republican Party put out a statement that they were not opposed to Hispano fourth term, to having a fourth term in this manner. So
they were opposed to having a fourth term under what?
In this manner, where the council votes for it and it doesn't go to referendum. So you were on the same page with the party statement issued by Chairman John Larkin. So we'll have to see how this plays out in next year's election.
Are we going to hear things? Are we going to hear a challenge? Do you think there'll be legal challenges from John Larkin, or is it just?
I'm not an attorney, so I don't know what legal challenges are available. You know, I can only read the laws that I'm familiar with and draw a conclusion. And I looked at, as I said, I looked at New York State's Municipal Home Rule Law. I looked at the Yonkers City Charter, and there's nothing in there that prohibits this. Is there something within the federal constitution, Voting Rights Act, or anything else that prohibits this? I doubt it. Otherwise, it would have been used 4 years ago.
Right. All right. So why are we so hung up on term limits up to a certain point? Is it just a process, Mike?
I guess we feel that if somebody serves 12 years or 8 years, mm-hmm. then other people deserve a chance. And you know, that was...
They have a chance because if they're, it's an election. It's not like it's a given.
No, that's true. It's an election.
That's a vote.
You know, but part of the problem in Yonkers is that, you know, less than 20% show up to vote.
Uh-huh.
I think 14% showed up last year on a citywide race.
Mm-hmm.
Is it conceivable
that this process will energize people to go out to vote?
Maybe.
Is that emotional about it?
There's 140,000 eligible voters in Yonkers. The highest number I've seen of late is when Liam ran against Mike Cater.
Uh-huh.
And that, I don't remember the exact numbers, but I think that's the highest number in recent history for a non-presidential election. And I think
mm-hmm.
that is, or, you know, an off-year election. And I think that is due to the Constitutional Convention being that same year.
Mm-hmm.
That's the year that Rob Astorino lost the county executive seat.
All right.
So you had a lot of union labor. You had a lot of municipal union labor coming out and voting that year because they wanted to make sure that their pension benefits were not altered.
Well, it does seem like the unions have grown in prowess in the last few years. Because at one time they waned, and now they seem to be coming back.
It's
the county, at least.
Well, I think municipal unions, 456 has always been pretty strong. A few years ago, they had some internal problems, and that was all cleaned up. It's a very professional organization. And that's, you know, CSEA, I'm not as familiar with. 456.
I don't know them either.
I managed a 456 contract in Greenwich. I was impressed. I was impressed with the forthrightness. And not only that, I was impressed with how the shop steward held his own people to excellence because they wanted to show that it mattered having union labor. And that's when you want to manage a union, when the union manages itself. You know, I always appreciated the guys at 456 because they police themselves. You know, they would keep themselves in line.
Looks like he is, but for some reason or another, what they're doing because they don't inform anybody of these changes. Oh gosh. Not quite sure here. It looks like there's some sort of a problem. It says here all of a sudden that there's a website is under maintenance. I've never seen that before. So it looks like we are on, but I don't know what happened. Okay, it looks like the system may have cut off Ron. It's not a nice thing. Definitely not nice. Okay. 1 second here. Let me see if this takes. Wow. Let me just see if I've got this. Let me see if I can get back to the studio. And we're back at the studio, but somehow or another, it has logged. It automatically logged off Ron Matten. I have no idea why. No sense to me. Okay. Well, it looks like he's been logged off, and I can't seem to get him, so I'm just going to disconnect, and we'll just end the episode. We thank you for being with us.